everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of fthismovie.net. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I am joined at long last for a discussion of The Truman Show, making his triumphant return all the way from now New York City by Alex Lawson.
Nothing you hear on F This Movie is fake. It's just merely controlled. Thank you for having me, Patrick.
Thank you for coming back. How have you been in your absence?
Yeah, no, it's good. I apologize, I guess, for the people who might demand one. Can't imagine who they would be.
Apology accepted.
Yeah. Like as you said, I live in New York now with my girlfriend, doing all the exciting things.
Sort of a humble brag there, wasn't it?
Yeah, a little bit.
No, whatever. It's no big deal. I live with a girl, but no, it's totally fine. I mean, we kiss and stuff, but no, I mean, no big deal, whatever.
I'm not above that. I've never pretended to be. I've seen some New York celebrities, and by celebrities, I mean, just piles of garbage on the street in the sweltering sun. I haven't seen anything yet.
New York has the most famous piles of garbage.
Yeah, that's what
piles of garbage. Are you talking about those Real Housewives?
Yeah. Also, Piper Perabo. Saw her. Yeah.
You burnt. Bravo. Did you really see Piper Perabo?
Yeah, I did.
Star of The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle?
Yeah, that's right. What else? Bully. Wasn't she in that Brad Renfro Bully movie?
No, you're thinking of Bijou Phillips. Piper Perabo is not in Bully. Piper Perabo is in Coyote Ugly. Piper Perabo is
in Cheaper by the Dozen movies. Patrick, I'm not going for Coyote.
She's in Lost and Delirious. She's in The Prestige. She's in Looper. I'll keep going.
Because I can't go, clearly. Obviously. For the record, I could have on Coyote Ugly. I was trying to think of.
I know that. She's not in Bully. No, I'm sorry. So we're talking about The Truman Show tonight via an experiment that we did last week. We put it out there on the social media, and we said, "Hey, what do you guys think we should do a show on?" And we got lots of good answers. And a couple people requested The Truman Show, so we said, well, that's on Netflix Instant, let's do that. And in a weird coincidence, I didn't even realize this when we selected this movie, 2 weeks ago, Doug and I did a show on Can't Hardly Wait, right?
Right, right.
That movie opened in 1998, I believe the week after The Truman Show came out.
Oh, wow.
So what I'd like to do is just, on a week-by-week basis, just cover the summer of 1998.
Right. Well, we're off to a running start. I realized that too after when I looked up what year this came out, because I listened to the Can't Hardly Wait show and I was like, this is another 15th anniversary show.
Yeah.
And this doesn't make this, I can't quantify this at all, but like both you and Doug expressed like incredulity that like, oh, it's been 15 years since Can't Hardly Wait came out.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah. Somehow 15 years sounds about right for The Truman Show in some ways. I don't know for me. I don't know why that would be or what that makes no sense, I realize. But it didn't shock me. I was like, yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
So those of you who requested something that we did not select and you're feeling defeated and disappointed, fear not. Your suggestions will, of course, be taken into consideration for future episodes of F This Movie. Remember, you can always email show suggestions to fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. You should follow us on Twitter for the next time we solicit show suggestions. We are at F This Movie. And you should like us on Facebook so you can keep up with that business by going to facebook.com/fthismovie. And, of course, our website, as always, is fthismovie.net. Alex.
I'm going to get that F This Movie Vine account
up
and running.
Six seconds of nothing. Alex, have you seen anything good lately?
I've seen many good things since I was last on the show, because it's been quite some time, of course. You guys have covered so many of the big, the high-profile releases and stuff. I mean, I've seen Pacific Rim and, like, I don't know. What's all the other? I don't know.
I think it was just Pacific Rim.
If memory serves, it's only
Pacific Rim. Do you have like a favorite movie of the summer thus far?
I think it would be Pacific Rim.
Yeah.
I saw it twice the opening weekend. We don't have to spend a lot of time on it because, like, you guys did a whole show on it. Yeah. I liked it more than both you and JB did.
Yeah.
I acknowledge the flaws that you guys raised, certain sort of plot threads that don't go a lot of places. But the good moments, like, so far outshadowed the things that left me wanting that really thoroughly enjoyed myself. But we don't have to spend a lot of time on that. I saw a couple of documentaries on Netflix. One was a documentary from 2010 called Senna.
Yes.
You know that movie? Yeah.
I know of it. I have not seen it. I know Doug just watched it during Junesploitation and liked it a lot.
Oh, yeah. Me too. Yeah. Oh, did he talk about it on the show?
He didn't. He just reviewed it. I think he watched it on Car Day. And,
Yeah.
And wrote about it.
I really like that movie. That plays out. I mean, first of all, people don't know, it's a documentary about a Brazilian Formula One race car driver. His name is Ayrton Senna. And, it's told entirely, at least visually, there is narration, but the visuals are all entirely like existing footage, just archive footage, which I'm always impressed by. It's kind of difficult to, I mean, it's difficult to tell a story that way, and it does it admirably. And the whole thing kind of, it has this arc of like some kind of like a, he's like a Hercules or some kind of like Greek, like some kind of fable, the way he's like, such a prolific, race car driver, right down to the fact that he excels at driving when it's raining outside. Like, obviously that makes a lot of drivers more cautious, but for him, it was like, it empowered him.
Interesting.
And it's on, it's just really, really interesting. It just, there are like these onboard shots, there was like a camera mounted in his car, and like, it's a very simple visual device, but you're just like, oh my God, he's going so damn fast. It's really crazy that anybody would do that for a living. As I said, that's on Netflix. You should check that out. And then, I will talk about another one. Another documentary is called The Invisible War.
Yes, that I've seen. That's Kirby Dick, right?
Yes.
Okay.
It's the documentary. I think it's from last year, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's about sexual assault in the military.
Yeah.
It's told, there's like four or five, maybe more women who sort of tell their stories, and it's a really hard story to listen to, but a very well-made movie, and something that, an issue that definitely demands attention, and is available for people to watch. It's weird. Like I sat down and like, I thought about what I could say about it, 'cause I knew I wanted to talk about it. It's just like, I don't even know, like the subject matter is so intense that I don't even really know even how to like approach it. Like
it's weird
with like a critical eye, you know, like, I mean, it's very good.
You know? Well, right. I mean, on its face, you could say, well, it's just a bunch of talking heads, and a lot of documentaries have gotten away from that, but you know, their stories are compelling, and not in like an entertaining way that we normally talk about, but the subject matter is interesting in the way that it's horrible and frustrating. And not to spoil anything, although it's a documentary, so spoilers for real life. The documentary, I believe, unless I'm remembering this wrong, actually led to some policy change, no?
Leon Panetta, when he was the Secretary of Defense, took the prosecution of those crimes, or the investigation of those crimes, out of the chain of command, which means like you don't, like people can go above their officers, I guess, to report stuff, which is, you know, I mean, it's not a definitive step, but it's definitely something that was raised repeatedly in the documentary. I don't know, you know, so.
It's a step in the right direction, and it's nice that as every once in a while, like, film can impact real life, you know, in a positive way.
Yeah, that's good. I think I've seen a ton of stuff since I was on last time, but in the interest of brevity, I'll turn it over to you.
What's the worst movie you've seen this summer?
You know, I haven't seen a lot of bad I've gone out of my way to, like, not, like, I didn't see things that, like, I thought would be really bad.
Was there anything that you were really looking forward to that ended up being bad, you thought?
I mean, I was like a lot of people, I was really disappointed by Man of Steel, but I mean, that's not a bad movie in the way that you're talking about.
Sure.
I really haven't seen a lot of, like, out and out bad things.
That's good.
That's more like I haven't sought out the things that I think might be bad, but
right.
It sounds like you have a really bad thing you want to talk about.
No, not really. I've seen
what I feel like
are a lot of bad movies this summer. And I don't think Pacific Rim is a bad movie at all. And if you listen to the podcast, I said I basically liked it, but
of course,
to be totally honest, I have not thought about it once since we recorded that podcast. And
see, I can't stop thinking about it.
Right. And I get that. And I know that it's really speaking to people in a certain way, not necessarily like, oh, what it's about is so profound that I'm connected to it, but just that it entertained people to such a degree that they keep thinking about it. They want to go back to it. They have so much fun with it. And that's great. I love when a movie can do that. I understand why the movie is doing that for some people. It just is not doing that at all with me. It is out of my memory, unfortunately.
No, I'm sorry.
You
should enter into the neural handshake with me, and then you will experience it the way I do.
I would just drag you down into the muck with me, and you would start to see nothing but problems.
The 50-50 shot. I don't know. let's just hold off. Let's forget it.
Sure. I saw a movie that was released this weekend called The Conjuring.
Oh, okay.
Which is a terrible title for a movie because it has nothing to do with what the movie is about. Adam Riske wrote a review of the movie. You can read it at fthismovie.net. I basically am in agreement with everything he said, which is just it's kind of a fun horror movie that is scary in an enjoyable way and not in a way that is punishing or depressing. It likes its characters. It has a belief and a faith in humanity that most horror movies don't have. And the script is not always great. And there are certain lines of dialogue that you think that's what they went with. But James Wan, I got to say, directs the shit out of it. And I think it's worth seeing more than once just to appreciate some of the ways that he sets up set pieces and some of the shots he uses are just, I really had a good time with it and I was surprised. I mean, I wanted to see it, but it wasn't, you know, super high on my list. And, it's one of the better things I've seen this summer for sure.
What is the basic, like what is the back of the DVD, like, summary of that? Is that just like a haunted house movie or I don't know?
Yeah,
like,
basically, family moves in a family. It's Lily Taylor and Ron Livingston, who is like the unsung hero of the movie. He's so good.
Oh, I did not know that they were the couple. That sounds like I've seen like two commercials for this movie and I haven't like read anything or know anything.
No, the cast is really good. They're the couple and they have a family of like five girls. They move into this house. It's set in 71 or 72. They move into this house and things start happening. The house, you know, they believe to be haunted. So they call on this couple, the Warrens, Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga, who are experts in this sort of thing. And they are based on real people. It was the couple that was sort of involved in investigating the Amityville case, you know, that Horror was based on. So sometimes I feel like the movie cuts itself off at the knees a little bit to try and tell the story of the Warrens, because they're real living people, and I'm sure they had certain obligations to tell their story a certain way. I wish it had been, you know, able to cut loose a little bit more with the fiction aspect, but whatever. So they come in and investigate, and it's a very basic setup, you know. And I'm not a big fan of, like, the ghost movie or the haunting movies, but I really enjoyed it. Two other.
Right, go ahead.
Somehow I've seen a lot of horror movies lately, which is weird. Maybe I'm finally accepting the reality that October is coming.
You're gearing up, I think.
I saw two smaller, basically straight to DVD horror movies. One is called Would You Rather, which is sort of what it sounds like. Jeffrey Combs, who's worth seeing in anything, and basically what drew me to the movie in the first place, throws a dinner party attended by Brittany Snow, late of the WB, and John Hurd, late of
The dad from Home Alone.
The dad from Home Alone, and I believe he was also in Sharknado, which
my new fish hooks
really needs to.
Oh, I can't
go
I
mean, fuck itself. Yeah, my new fish hooks, nice.
Yeah,
grow a goatee. and Sasha Grey of porn fame, they're all at this dinner party, and it basically turns into this game where Jeffrey Combs, you know, asks them, "Would you rather shock the person next to you, or, you know, get smacked on the back with a bamboo rod?" And they have to choose. And
this sounds like a reality TV show. Or
it kind of does, and it's an interesting premise, and it's compelling for a while. And then you realize they don't have anywhere to go with it. It sounds like it's going to be some sort of Saw-esque, like, torture thing. And it's not really. The movie doesn't go too far with that aspect. But it needs to reinvent itself in the third act. And spoilers, it doesn't. It just sort of plays this thing straight through. I'm not advocating that movies need twists, but this was a movie that needed to twist. And I don't mean, like, it has to spring a surprise on you. I'm just saying it has to go in a new direction.
Yeah.
And the movie doesn't. And so, not a bad movie, but kind of a frustrating one. And then the last one I'll talk about was actually a recommendation that also came out of Junesploitation. On one of the Free Space days, I believe one of our listeners, Shannon Briggs, watched a movie called American Mary. And had a lot of good things to say about it, so I sought it out. American Mary is a movie written and directed by these twin sisters. I want to say they're the Soska twins. I might have that wrong. It stars Catherine Isabel from Ginger Snaps, and she's in Freddy vs. Jason, as a would-be surgeon, a med student, who hits some bad things happen to her. And she finds herself in this underground world of what they call extreme body modification.
Okay.
Which, again, sounds like it would get super sort of gory.
Yeah.
It owes way more to like, David Cronenberg than it does to, again, the Saw series.
I see. Okay.
In the way that it's sort of this body horror. Super interesting idea. Great performance by Catherine Isabel. The direction is really interesting. It's just another movie that sets up all these interesting things and then doesn't quite know how to land it. And so I think it's worth seeing, and it's a movie that I know I'll go back to try and pull some more meaning out of it. Cause I think the movie does have a lot of things to say in it. I just wish, like, watching these horror movies inspired me to go back and rewatch The Woman from a couple years ago, which, if you guys haven't seen it, it's on Netflix Instant. And I think that's the best horror movie in the last 10 years.
That movie's great.
I love that movie. And that's a movie that knows how to stick the landing.
From start to finish, like, the tone is great. The way it sort of climbs and then goes in, like, a weird, weird twisted shit that, like, you don't see coming, but, like, works in a just a very organic way. Yeah.
And it's a movie that's not for everybody because, again, I know if you go on, like, the Amazon reviews or even IMDb, if you hate yourself.
Some low-hanging fruit. Yeah.
Well, I mean, a lot of people, the big complaint is the use of music in the movie because he does some really interesting things with the music choices. It works 100% for me. I know that it won't for everyone, so I'm not suggesting you people are wrong for not liking that, but everything about that movie works for me. So I think Would You Rather and especially American Mary are worth checking out. I left both a little bit frustrated, one more than the other, but interesting nonetheless, and you know, that's more than I can say for some movies I've seen this year. So
with American Mary, is that on Netflix Instant somewhere?
It's not. It's on DVD and Blu-ray. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you just purchased it?
I did. Best Buy a thing where you turn in an old DVD and they give you $5 off a movie. So I think I got it for like $7. And it's worth it. I mean, I'll watch it again. So it's my $7 is well spent. I spend more money than that to see Grown Ups 2. So,
Yeah.
At least that was for work. Anyway, so let's move into the summer of 1998 and talk about.
It was a simpler time.
It was. It was a crazy time because let me tell you something. When 98 happened, when it was over, I thought it wasn't a very good year for movies. And even in retrospect, I've always held that 98 was not that good. And I think that's because it was sandwiched right between 97, which I thought was fantastic, and 99.
Which we've well documented.
Which is, incredible. And so I was always like, 98's not that good. And yet, a ton of good stuff came out in 98. So I was selling it short, but the summer was this crazy place. And I was looking at the movies that came out the summer of The Truman Show, because as I rewatched The Truman Show for the first time in over 10 years, for sure.
Oh, okay.
I saw the movie in 98. I think I watched it once more when I bought it on DVD in probably 99 or 2000, and I don't think I've seen it since then.
Oh, wow.
So okay. It was interesting to go back and see it again. And I was watching it thinking, holy shit, this was like a studio. This is a major release. This movie cost $60 million, was put out by Paramount in the middle of summer. How did they sneak an art movie into the summer movie season, into the blockbuster summer movie season? So then I started to look, well, what else was out at the time? And yes, there were big summer movies. This was the summer
Godzilla,
of
Godzilla, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. This was the summer of Godzilla. This was the summer of Armageddon.
Oh, which
you and I have talked more than once about doing a show on, and I almost don't want to now because I have this weird feeling that I would be way nicer to Armageddon than I want to be. So,
yeah. You're like, you're building up your apologies the longer we talk about it.
Exactly. So I don't want to be the guy who's like, I don't know, Armageddon is not the worst, because it probably is the worst, but it does some things right that summer movies don't do anymore. So there's these big, dumb, expensive movies. I mean, on the same weekend in 98, Godzilla was released, which is, the epitome of a stupid summer special effects blockbuster. And also released that day is Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Oh, wow.
This fucking insane art movie directed by Terry Gilliam, released by Universal, like starring Johnny Depp when he was interesting. So you have this weird mix of...
Did that get a wide release, Fear and Loathing?
Yes. Oh, wow. I mean, that movie came out like a summer movie. I don't know what they were thinking. And thank God they thought it, because I'm glad that I live in a world where that came out in the summer, from Universal. But I don't know what they were thinking.
Because this year, like, that gets like a small run.
If at all, right. If that movie gets made,
it
doesn't come out. And so it's nice to see that, there were weekends where three or four movies came out, and they're all a little bit different and all maybe interesting. And that doesn't happen anymore. Now you get one, maybe two. Maybe you get the big dumb action movie and the kids animated movie, but that's it.
Right.
Which is a long prelude to talk about
The
Truman Show. What's your relationship? I mean, have you always been a fan? Are you not a fan? Do you still like it? Where are you at on The Truman Show?
I've seen it more than you.
Yeah.
It's one of those movies I've watched it every, I don't know, 3 or 4 years or something. Okay. I mean, I'll usually pop it on, or it's like on TV sometimes. And it's a movie I've always found, like we were just saying, I've always found it interesting,
mm-hmm.
and I've always found it, it definitely is a piece of art. The central conceit of it is so interesting. And I think that the story is interesting enough, and like a lesser filmmaker than Peter Weir would like rest on the laurels of like just having this cool idea for a movie and maybe shoot it in like a pretty boilerplate style. Like, but I really like the way in which he tells the story, and we can talk about that a little bit later. However, something that always kind of rubs me the wrong way, although as I said, not in a way that turns me off and makes me never want to see it again, because I watch it, pretty regularly. There are some tonal things that always kind of leave me at a loss. And the movie makes some interesting choices that don't always quite wash with me. But to your point about wondering how it got made, like now, and how it got made then, and like what it would be like now if it would come out in the middle of the summer or whatever. I mean, I think the answer to that is that this is at the point when all of the Jim Carrey cachet was like built up, right? Like this is right off of Liar Liar.
Yeah.
Where, well, he did, you know, he did the two Ace Venturas and then tried to go sort of outside the box comedy with the Cable Guy. I don't know how, I don't know what your feelings are about the Cable Guy. I've always kind of liked it.
Yeah, it's problematic, but it's yeah. good. It's better than a lot of stuff he did.
Right, and that got a little pushback, and then he does Liar Liar, which everybody loves. You know, yeah. you take your kids to see it and all that. And then I think that this is like, I've always found it to be a really interesting movie within, like, his career canon.
Yeah.
Just because, like, the conceit of this movie is, like, there's this one guy that everybody is obsessed with. And I don't know, I didn't do enough, I was derelict in my research. I don't know if other people were considered for this role. Do you know about that?
I know, it had been around for a while and went through many drafts. I know at the point at which they landed on Jim Carrey, it was a good 2 or 3 years before it came out. And I believe it was Peter Weir who said he wanted Jim Carrey, and Jim Carrey wanted to do it but was contracted to do at least 2 other movies. And so they put the movie on hold for 2 or 3 years while he went off and made a couple more movies and then could come back to make The Truman Show, which is interesting because when they selected him, he still wasn't the Jim Carrey that he was when it came out. They didn't know how huge he was even going to be 3 years down the line when they picked him to do the movie. Yeah.
Which is why this is, that's so fascinating to me. There's just like this, this conceit of like everybody is so obsessed with this one person and like he wasn't, I mean, Jim Carrey did not captivate the world in the way that Truman is portrayed here. But I mean, it's a satire of a lot of things or whatever. But I always thought he was such a perfect choice for the role, and he's really good in it. I think it's one of the best performances he's ever given.
I would agree with that, except that I think his work in it is a little bit overpraised because I think he's fine in the role. I think he's good, and I think it's a really interesting movie that he chose to make, and I think he's the exact right guy for the job, and I like the way that he is sort of inverting his celebrity and many of the things for which he came to be known. The weird plasticity of his smile in this movie takes on a whole new context.
Yes, yes.
So yeah. I think that's interesting. But I also think, you know, in a lot of ways, he's just doing Jim Carrey. And I don't mean crazy Jerry Lewis, Ace Ventura, Jim Carrey. I just mean he's sort of just being a version of himself. And maybe that is good acting from him to play a normal guy. Maybe I'm underestimating how difficult that is. But I was always, you know, when it came out, I think people were so shocked to see him do something different, even though I never felt like it was so far outside of his wheelhouse, but everyone was like, oh wow, Jim Carrey's doing a drama. He's not doing super heavy drama in the movie. And I think so much of the work is done by the fact that it's Jim Carrey in this very specific role. That's sort of about what it's like to be Jim Carrey.
Yeah. There are departures that he makes from, like, what I think is the more interesting tone of the movie, but I don't, like, dock points off his performance of that. I think that's, like, weird storytelling problems that we can get into a little bit later. That's kind of splitting hairs. But we're even almost getting a little bit too micro yet. I mean, we, like, went into the Jim Carrey thing right off the bat. But I really like the movie. Every time I watch it, like, I mean, it's so, this is like the laziest like thing critics, I don't know, cause not that I'm a critic or something, but like, like that people say about movies that have a message that it like gains resonance as we move on. But like, it does kind of gain, it kind of like means more and more as like with like the proliferation of media and the way people consume it and stuff. It just seems more and more topical every time I watch it.
I would absolutely agree with that. And I don't see the movie necessarily pointed to as much as, say, the way that we point to something like Network and say Network predicted the change of media and it predicted the rise of the 24-hour news cycle and all these things that we always say Network is prophetic. And I wonder if some of that is because Network is such an angry movie. Network is the kind of movie that's standing on top of a hill shouting. And the Truman Show isn't. But I think in so many ways, the Truman Show is just as prophetic as network, because again, when the Truman Show came out, it may have been the same year, maybe a year after, like Survivor premiered. And to me, right. I know MTV had been doing The Real World, but Survivor to me is sort of the start of reality TV in terms of, oh, it's a huge hit on a major network. We can put this on every night. And, yeah. and for me, Survivor is what really changed. And it came out around the same time, if I don't have the exact date, but my memory is that it came out right around the same time.
It's close, yeah.
As The Truman Show. Well, so this movie was yeah. not commenting on something that was already happening.
That's the thing, too. And that's, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I want to make clear what I was saying about how it gains resonance as it goes on, because I don't even know that it's trying to, even though like now it seems to have all these things to say about like the way people, consume media and like reality television and all that stuff. I mean, you can make the argument that it's not even commenting on reality TV. It's commenting on reality as we know it. Like Ed Harris delivers that great line about like when Harry Shearer asks him, why hasn't Truman caught on to what's going on? And he says, we accept the reality with which we are presented.
Right.
And that's like that's a comment about the human condition, if anything. Like, I mean, yeah. he could be talking about any person walking down the street, not a person who is the unwitting star of a reality television show. So, I mean, I never had a camera in Peter Weir's head, to borrow one of his own phrases that's used in the movie. So I don't know how much he was sitting around saying, Andrew Niccol wrote the script, I guess, but... how much they thought about like, oh man, we've got it so right. I mean, I think it's more of a movie about like, you know, how you struggle, not struggle, but I mean, how you perceive your own reality. I'm going to sound like some jagoff philosophy student or something, but, I think it's more concerned with that than any kind of media comment. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I definitely, and this is probably getting too far ahead because I know we're going to go down this path eventually, but I definitely think ultimately, you know, unfortunately the movie lands in this place of sort of just being about, you know, free will and choosing our own destiny. And that's fine. That's a fine message, but it's less interesting to me than the media stuff. And I definitely would agree that it has some things to say about the nature of reality, but I think the fact that he chose television is very pointed, and that he chose it for a very specific reason.
Yeah.
And just again that he has these ideas about what people what we would be willing to watch. I mean, nothing interesting really happens to Truman, and yet it's all people can watch because we're just fascinated by seeing someone else do the same shit that we do. The willingness to exploit a person's actual life as entertainment. Again, these weren't concepts that were common when this movie was written and came out. And yet we can have those discussions about almost anything we see on TV now. Is it worth exploiting these people's lives, just for our sort of empty entertainment?
Right. And I mean, the of course different conceit between any show, well, I guess like other than like Candid Camera or something, which is a different kind of thing, but like, is the issue of like consent, right? Like the fact that, you know, he has had no say in the matter, and it's this, I mean, now we're getting way too into it. I mean, I don't know. You need to get this back on the rails at some point. But like, Ed Harris has like those great lines about that he is shielding Truman from like the actual bad things,
right?
And that what he has built for him is better than anything that could ever happen to him. I mean, there's never been a TV show like that, and I don't think there ever will be, because that is like really terrible and morally wrong.
Yeah,
there's a lot of morally wrong stuff that makes it to TV, so I guess I don't know for sure. But that's why I sort of, you know, need to keep having this tug of war about what the movie is and isn't about. It's an interesting movie that's about a lot of things. That's the point,
right?
But
it's a summer movie starring Jim Carrey, and it's like, wow, we can have all these interesting conversations. And yet, I don't think the movie plays as particularly heady. I mean, it's totally digestible and entertaining, and it's and that's one of its accomplishments, is that it presents all these things in a way that is very accessible.
Yeah.
And doesn't beat you over the head with its messaging until maybe the last half hour, and then I think there's some problems, which we'll get to. But I do want to point out, you know, this happens all the time in Hollywood, where two movies come out around the same time that are very similar. In 98,
You beat me to the punch. This is going to be great. I was wondering which of us was going to mention it first.
In 98, it happened with Deep Impact and Armageddon. It had happened, I think, the year before with Dante's Peak and Volcano. We saw it happen last year with Mirror, Mirror and Snow White and the Huntsman. I feel like it just happened this year.
I can't think
of what it was.
I used to be able to rattle these off.
Yeah. But it's a fairly common thing where all of a sudden, within a pretty short time span, that two movies come out and you think, boy, how were they both in on these meetings?
It was White House Down and Olympus.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
So Truman Show comes out in 98, and in most cases I feel like the second movie is the superior one.
Yeah,
for whatever reason.
True. I don't have chronological memory of all of these things. Like, I don't, like, did Deep Impact come out first?
Yes.
Okay. I think you're right. That is my litmus test. just that one. If I know that Deep Impact came out first, then yeah, I think you're right. Because I think White House is Down is better than Olympus Has Fallen.
I still haven't seen Olympus Has Fallen, but I did not like White House Down. So Truman Show comes out in 98, and here's where the theory doesn't hold, because early the following year?
Yeah, it did come out in 99.
Yeah, in like March of 99. Yeah. Ron Howard's Ed TV comes out, which is sort of the same idea of a guy whose life is filmed 24 hours a day for a TV show. And the difference being, of course, that he signs up for it, whereas Truman is this unwilling participant. But you have the same basic idea of a TV show, a TV network, you know, devoted exclusively to filming one person's life nonstop, and it becomes a sensation. And it's interesting to see how the Truman Show makes art from that premise, and Ed TV makes a sitcom from that premise.
Although I have to cop to something. When I was in 1999, when Ed TV came out, I was in junior high, and I may or may not have done their chicken dance down the hallway at my junior high school on more than one occasion, because this is many years before Arrested Development, and that was what we had in the way of chicken dances, and man, was that funny. To 14-year-old me, that was like the apex of comedy at that moment. Anyway, that's a digression, but yes, you're right. That is a movie with entirely different goals, and kind of achieves them, I guess, but not in any real interesting way. I don't know. I mean, you can.
I don't. I mean, Ed TV, unfortunately, really is not about anything. And I bring it up only to say,
right,
you know, it's to the Truman Show's credit that it takes a premise and really does something with it, because another group of writers and a filmmaker, you know, of Ron Howard's stature, chose to make really nothing out of it, you know, and like you said, obviously it has different goals, but with the same premise, two people made two very different movies, and I think one is successful. Watching the Truman Show was always a movie I liked, but not one that I thought about a ton, and as people were recommending it for this podcast, a number of people said, great movie, and my memory of it was never as a great movie, although I think it definitely just sort of has that status in the collective consciousness, because it was pretty beloved when it came out. It made a bunch of money. Critics kind of went crazy for it. It got nominated for some awards. People were shocked that Jim Carrey didn't receive a Best Actor nomination. I feel like that would have been overboard, but okay.
I don't remember who else was in the field that year. That's not that important.
It's just sort of accepted as being a great movie, and my memory of it was never that it was a great movie, but it was a good movie. And rewatching it this time, for the first 45 minutes to an hour, I was thinking, oh, I might have been wrong. This actually might be a great movie. I was liking it more than I remembered ever liking it. And I was amazed at some of the things it had to say, and the way that Peter Weir exaggerates reality in such a way. And I don't mean, you know, the clean cut nature of like the Laura Linney performance or the White Picket Fences or whatever. I just mean even the weird cartoon slide whistle when that light falls at the beginning.
Yeah.
It's this weird sort of nightmare. It's this squeaky clean nightmare. And not in the way that like David Lynch does in Blue Velvet, where it's like, look, it's perfect, but underneath it's all fucked up. Like, that's not what he's doing. He's just presenting the squeaky clean side of it, but in such a way that it feels like a nightmare. And it's fascinating what he's able to accomplish. And the movie does something that is very daring structurally. And I've always been impressed by the willingness to do it, which is that for about an hour, it just plays as the Truman Show.
I had the same thought too.
Yeah.
I mean, I do every time I watch it. Yeah.
And then at about the hour mark, it sort of switches perspective. And now we're outside the Truman Show talking to Ed Harris as Christoph, the creator and sort of overseer of the show. And the rest of the movie plays from sort of outside the Truman Show bubble. Mm-hmm. And it's very, like I said, it's very daring structurally, because any number of movies would have bounced back and forth the whole time. Yeah. And this movie doesn't. So it does something really interesting. So when we get to the moment where Ed Harris is watching Jim Carrey, Truman sleep on this enormous screen, and Philip Glass's sort of haunting piano music is playing, it's you know, definitely the most sort of powerful image in the movie, and it's so sad and so weirdly beautiful at the same time, because Ed Harris really is watching his child sleep and means it and loves Truman.
Yeah.
But it's fucked up, you know. It's not real love. It's this weird.
And it's like repugnant that it happened the way it did. Like,
exactly. Yeah, right. Yeah. It's sort of this weird love that like Frankenstein has for his monster, you know? So it's this beautiful fucked up image. And I thought, oh man, this movie is really something. And then the same thing happened to me that has happened the last few times I watched it, which is the air kind of slowly gets sucked out of the movie. And I think the choice to structure it that way is ultimately damaging to the movie, because I think once you're past that certain that first hour, you lose the arc and the emotional connection to the Truman character, and he's really your link to the movie. So now it becomes this bird's eye perspective of what's playing out, which is compelling enough, but in the way that you're suddenly, you are Christoph watching the Truman Show. You're removed from this thing, just watching it unfold without actually being connected to it. Whereas in the first hour, you're right in the middle of it. You are in the Truman Show. And so I feel like that emotional tie gets severed for the last 40 minutes. And that's always been a problem for me.
But doesn't, I take your point, and I have a problem with a shift that happens in the middle, though.
The way you say I take your point makes me think you're about to say, but I don't take your point.
That's one of my secret argument tricks. Just sneak in I take your point, or the classic to your point.
You're allowed to say what you just said.
Make people think. I kind of disagree. I have a problem with the turn that the movie takes too, but it's for a different reason than you're saying.
Okay.
Mine is purely I don't think Truman's actions make a lot of sense.
Okay.
But in terms of my investment in it, that's not really altered for me. So like basically the last hour or 45 minutes is just like an adventure story about whether or not he will be able to, you know, sort of, you know, rid himself of this thing that he's now wise to. Is that is that just too, like, that's just too much like any other, like, standard, like, boring movie plot?
No, I don't think so. It's just that I feel like he plays such a little part in those last 40 minutes that it's like watching a character in a video game trying to escape something, or it's like watching a... It's like watching a worm try and get away from a bird, you know? And I understand. I think some of that is what the movie's going for. So, of course, you're rooting for the worm because you're like, ah, don't get eaten. But at the same time, it's not the same as being another worm on the ground, like watching that worm. This metaphor really went off the
rails. I was with you for a little bit there. Let me tell you why I don't have any reason for why it still holds up for me, because what I'm about to say, the first time I saw this, it's a summer movie and it had Jim Carrey in it, so it seems silly of me to say it. I really thought that, and I was fairly young when I saw this movie, but I really thought that there was a chance that he might die. And that would have really, like, that really would have thrown me for a loop.
Sure.
Because it gets really intense, and then Christoph shows this cold sort of detachment to the whole thing, which presents some problems of like motivation or something. Because he makes that line about like, you know, you can't die on it in front of a live audience. He says, well, he was born in front of a live audience, and at that moment, there was a legitimate question about whether or not he would survive, and that is unique among, you know, a certain type of, you know, blockbuster. This movie did fairly well, right?
I think it did really well, yeah.
Yeah. So, and now having said that, I know that it doesn't, I don't think that every time I watch it, so I guess I don't really know why I still am interested, but I don't have the same problems that you do. Let me tell you the problem that I do have, though, and that's just the, I think the movie cheats a little bit you know, like you said, it has that great turn where for the whole first hour, we're just watching the Truman Show. Then it turns when he, you know, he's starting to get wise to all these weird things that are happening, and, you know, shit starts going wrong with the sets, and there's all these weird malfunctions that are starting to tip him off. But then they seem to dupe him back when they reintroduce his, you know, quotation marks, father into the show. And at least I mull this over every single time I see it. That seems to actually affect him. But then there's no more. They don't even show him again, I think, until he tricks them into thinking that he's fallen asleep in the basement, and then he's on the run.
Right.
That is, I mean, unless you're willing to tell me that Truman is actually faking that entire time when he, you know, is affected by the return of his father. Mm-hmm. That's really the only way you can sell that, right? Because otherwise he just decides to up and leave again.
Right.
I mean, and that really stuck out to me this time. I think about it every time, but I can't. And I don't know.
I would contend that to spell that out, we would be complaining is too on the nose, is not giving the audience enough credit that, oh gosh, they don't need to spell out the fact that he's faking that.
But he really goes after it.
That's the problem, is that, you know, I like something that could be read two ways, but you know, there is a problem there, because either he is falling for it in the sense that, you know, he is moved, and why wouldn't he be? Because ultimately it is the only father he's ever known.
Yeah.
And so there is a genuine emotional connection there for him, whether or not, you know, the guy is actually his father. So it would be natural for him to have that reaction, and maybe we're missing the scene where he recognizes, like, oh, but those feelings aren't real, those are manufactured, and chooses to do what he does. Or we're missing the scene where we really understand how, in a very short amount of time, Truman has mastered the ability of using his environment against his creators, you know, and to take this idea of performance that his whole life has ultimately become and use it against the people who are essentially enslaving him. And so I agree. I think the movie makes a leap there that, yes, could absolutely be justified one way or another, but the movie makes it unclear as to which way it's leaning.
Yeah, and I'm all about ambiguity. I don't care about that. Right.
It's problematic.
This is different, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. No, I would agree with that.
But yeah, I mean, that's my beef with that. But I
real quick to go back to something you had brought up. The movie cost $60 million to make. It made worldwide $264 million. So
good work if you can get it. You know?
Exactly. It made, okay. made about four times its budget. So it did very, very well.
That was Carrie, but they could have showed him, I don't know, scratching his ass for 2 hours, and it would have, which is essentially what the conceit of the Truman Show is.
Exactly, which is interesting.
Like,
yeah,
like, it's great. Like,
there's all these things that are super interesting about it. You know, yeah. Those last 40 minutes, again, while interesting to me, and I like that it shifts perspective, and I feel like all the performances there are good, and we get to see Paul Giamatti, and you know, all that is definitely watchable, and that in its own, you know, is kind of an interesting movie, but I feel like the shift away from Truman is problematic. The most problematic thing for me has always been those last 10 to 15 minutes where it's just about Truman trying to row away, being bombarded in a rainstorm, because I feel like, again, it's super repetitive. It's not necessarily told from true. We're not on the boat with Truman. We're up in the sky with Christoff. And I think that's – I don't want to say it's problematic, because I recognize that this is the filmmaker's intent, because it has made us a viewer of the Truman Show. We're watching, you know, what happens to him the same way that everybody on TV watches. So I understand that, but I do feel like there's an emotional connection that is missing. But I always felt like it was repetitive, and that it really makes this sort of playing God metaphor – much too obvious. That the movie is ever subtle about the way that Christoph is playing God, but just I feel like it hammers it in such a way, and maybe it's because it's just hammering this one note over and over again.
Yeah, this is like a weird argument to make when you're talking about like problems you have with paths that movies choose to take.
Yeah,
and maybe I'm not creative enough to think about it in a critical way. I can't, but like, it's always seemed so inevitable to me. Like, it's gotta, like, it must build to him trying to leave. Right.
Yeah.
And so, and I don't know, your issue is just from the, who it's being, the perspective it's being told from. I mean, that's essentially,
I mean, that's part of it, but also that last conflict. I don't have a problem with him trying to leave. Again, these are all, you know, the thing is, when we talk about, oh, the movie should have gone down a different path, I recognize that what the filmmakers, everything they did with intent. So this is what they wanted to do. This wasn't some mistake that they made. This is what they were after. It's implicit when I say, right. I wish it had gone down a different path for me. You know what I mean? I'm not suggesting that that would make it a better movie for everyone. I'm just saying, in terms of my response to it, because I always feel watching it like, oh gosh, you know, if it had still been told from Truman's perspective, and watching him try to escape and be foiled from his, you know, like when he's in the car driving with Laura Linney and all the cars pull out in front of him, those kinds of things, had it kept going with that. And maybe because we've already seen that, maybe, you know, Peter Weir decided it was time to see it from the other perspective. And maybe it is to put us in the position of a viewer of the Truman Show, as opposed to in Truman Burbank's shoes. I don't know, but,
I think my biggest wish, and I think what you're saying, about sort of bringing it outside and looking in from the outside, is like, I almost wish there was more conflict within Ed Harris's character. Okay. Like he almost seems to like be sort of like detached about the whole thing about like the fact that he's killing him, basically, or at least could be doing it. Like, can't you imagine a situation where like you're now getting the whole last 45 minutes essentially from Christoph's perspective, and like you can tell it in a way of like you feel his conflict within about like he wants to keep what he has going. But the only way to do that, like, he might have to destroy it in a way. Like, that's an interesting thing, but it's kind of just, I see what you're saying about how it's just sort of, you know, simplified, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. But, I mean, that's not really...
Well, the boat stuff to me is simplified. I don't have a problem with Christoph's actions or his motivations. And again, to me, he is sort of simplistic, maybe because we've just seen characters like him before. But there is something fascinating about him that, yes, he would willfully let Truman die almost as the punchline of this performance piece that he's put together. But he does also, in a weird way, care about him and love him, as evidenced by him standing in front of that big screen. I mean, I definitely feel like he does love him, but again, in this weird fucked up way, to where he loves this creation, he loves the power that he has over him, he loves what he represents and all these things. You know, does he care about him as a human being? No, not necessarily. And so that's interesting to me. I just feel like by the time we get to that boat with the rain, the conflict, A, becomes too literal, and B, there's just a sameness to it. And it's just that for 15 minutes. It's him rowing and getting pelted with rain and passing out. And we just kind of do that over and over again. And again, this is just my reaction, that I feel like those last 40 minutes push me out of the movie.
Yeah.
Slowly, in a way that I wish that they wouldn't.
Okay. Let me, if we can pivot really quickly, we've been talking about that for a while. This is the first movie I ever saw, that exposed me to the perfection that is Laura Linney. And I think
for me, it was Congo, by the way.
Oh yeah. Right. I forgot.
That was the first movie I think I ever saw Laura Linney in.
You know what? I might have seen Congo. I might have just lied. But I mean, this is I'm using that as like an inroad. So like, I just want to talk about some of like the more supporting performances.
Yeah.
Laura Linney is like sort of unassailably great in most things. I think we agree on this. Yes. Are you not in that camp?
I thought I was. She lately has been running a little hot cold with me. I think she's good in The Truman Show. I just watched her in this movie called The Details with Tobey Maguire and Elizabeth Banks. And I think her performance in that movie is so tone deaf that the movie's already not very good, but
yeah,
she almost ends up being the worst thing about it, which I didn't think was possible.
Well, let's put it this way. Like her ceiling is like when she's on. She will like make, like, I will see a movie because of her.
Sure.
She is not the draw of this movie by any means.
Right.
But
she's very good though.
She's really good. Yeah. If you want to hear about what, like, such, this is so obvious and I feel stupid that I never noticed this before today. About the name, like her name and his best friend's name, like that never dawned on me until today. Why they're named that? You know their name. You notice what their names are, right?
I don't remember.
Her name is Meryl, okay. and his best friend's name is that Noah Emmerich? Is that guy's name is?
Yeah,
yeah. His name is Marlon, and those are the names of two, right, you know, two of the most highly regarded actors. I'm speaking about Meryl Streep and Marlon Wayans.
No. Boom.
No, I'm such a dummy. I've seen this movie like 5 or 7 times, and I never got that until today.
Yeah, definitely did.
So that, kind of a winking dumb thing, but
yeah.
Laura Linney's really good, and I think Noah Emmerich's really good, because in that scene where he has that great line, it's being fed to him by Ed Harris. He says, the last thing that I'd ever do is lie to you.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot going on in that scene, on a lot of different levels, but from an acting perspective, like, just, if we're just, you know, critiquing Noah Emmerich's performance, if you don't know that the conceit of this movie is that it's all fake, like, he really sells that line.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, Not to give like, you know, actors like who like get all into their heads and like have to process shit. Like I don't want to go down that weird, stupid robot. Like there's a lot of complicated stuff going on, and he really nails it. And I've never like had an opinion about him really either way in any movie.
Yeah, he just is one of those guys who just shows up in a lot of stuff, and you say, hey, there's Noah Emmerich.
The Heavy and Super 8, which was weird. I think they're really good, and like they have very interesting. Peter Weir asks them to do really interesting tasks, right? Like, because they're acting, and they have to, you know, they're acting anyway, and they kind of have to like strike this very specific tone,
right? Laura Linney in particular is playing sort of the nightmare version of that character, and very much contributes to that tone of that I was describing earlier, where it's very bright, it's very sunny, it's very pleasant to look at, but there's something
those weird push-ins on her face.
Terrifying about it. Yeah. Something that's weird to me is how often the movie is referred to as being a comedy. And I don't know if it was just because Jim Carrey was in it, and so we all just sort of decided it was a comedy, or because there's sort of an absurdist bent to the whole thing. I think there are definitely funny moments. I think there is levity in it, but I would never describe this movie as being a comedy.
Yeah.
I feel like I could count the funny moments on one hand.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, and I'm glad you brought that up, because that circles it back to a thing I mentioned earlier when we started off talking about Jim Carrey's performance. I almost feel like there was for the parts that are funny, I almost feel like there's not a lot of this movie that feels like studio notes, but a lot of the times the funny stuff kind of feels like, hey, Jim Carrey's in the movie, we should probably have him do something a little bit goofy.
He's got that one moment, I think I know that you're talking about.
In the car when he like freaks out and does that. Well, that's very over the top, but I'm even also talking about the weird framing of that shot when he's gardening and his like ass is sticking up in the air. That was in a lot of trailers too. Like,
and see, to me, that's less about that's to me, that's always been the fucking nightmare version of a Norman Rockwell painting.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean,
that is straight out of the lines in that's straight out of, I don't mean the dialogue, I mean the actual lines of his body.
Yes.
That's straight out of Norman Rockwell. And I get what you're saying that, yeah, we're used to not just his butt sticking out, but also him talking out of it. So I understand why they put it in the trailer. Cause like there's Jim Carrey's ass. It may talk in the movie. So I understand why it's in all the trailers. To me, that has never jumped out as one of those things. And I know exactly what you're talking about, where it's not necessarily a studio note, but you do get the sense of...
Yeah, it feels shoehorned almost.
Yeah, where it's like, oh, we got to have a Jim Carrey moment.
To know...
the line in the car is...
That's, yeah.
Definitely.
He does that freak out laughing thing.
Yeah.
Would you like to know the one thing that always makes me laugh in this movie? Unassailable. It's very small. I can make you guess it, but I won't.
I have no idea.
Because you won't. The movie like almost exhausts itself. Like the whole movie is like based on constructing obstacles, right? Yeah. For him to not leave and not discover, right? It's all about giving him obstacles.
Yeah.
And so a lot of those gags could get old. However, when
is it the poster in the travel agent's office?
No. Although that is funny too.
I do like that one.
It's just the weird. It's a bit of physical comedy when he's in the hospital and he's following that nurse, and there's that fleet of people in wheelchairs, and they're all like they all simultaneously hurry to try and head him off at that T intersection in the hallway, and they're like 2 seconds too late, and you see the look on the old guy's face who's in the front of the pack, and he's just like, damn it, like, oh my god, they're just like feverishly pushing, and he just like scoots in front of them. Oh god, every time it's so damn funny.
I like the scene in the hospital when he's watching the surgery, and you can tell that they're all trying to figure out like how far can we take this while he's watching. I like that. I do like his final exasperated freak out when Laura Linney does her final advertisement.
Yeah.
And who are you talking to?
Who are you talking to?
And that, by the way, is so prescient, because that is exactly what has happened.
Yeah.
In TV shows with the advent of TiVos and the DVR that, you know, Americans are now fast forwarding through all their commercials. So advertisers are finding new ways of incorporating ads into the programs. I do not watch the real world, but my wife will from time to time. And I've seen on more than one occasion, you know, they're having their fights about who fucked who and who ate the peanut butter and whatever. And the show will literally stop cold. They go into a Subway, and this is like more than one season, so you can tell that Subway is a big sponsor. All of the cast go into a Subway. They show them ordering. They're not having side conversations like, yeah, so-and-so fucked, yeah, can I get a BMT? So-and-so fucked so-and-so. It's like they just show what they're ordering. They sit down. There's a couple minutes of them eating it, and then it goes back to the show. It's the crazy – I don't know who that's for. Are there 15-year-olds who are like, I'm going to go to Subway now?
It's been a long time since I watched The Real World, and that is
don't ever. But that's the most egregious example. I mean, that's straight out of The Truman Show. That is, you know, a show just stopping for a character to do an ad. And and I know, you know, when Andrew Niccol wrote it, I'm sure it was just out of necessity.
Because you have to generate revenue for that.
Right. That was him addressing the concern of, well, how would they have advertising on a 24-hour show? Well, here's what they would do. And it, you know, makes for some big laughs in the movie. The other thing that I always laugh at, and then I'll get off this topic. Actually, the last line, the last like 15 seconds of this movie, I think are so funny in the way that it just undercuts everything that came before it. And I don't think this is a movie that's bitter towards the American public, although you could certainly read it that way, their willingness to watch this show. But, you know, technically they do, I guess, root for Truman to escape. But the fickleness of those two guys, that this man just found his freedom, this show that they were hooked on, this show that the entire country watched 24 hours a day, he escapes, he finds his freedom, it is the greatest triumph, and they let's see what else is on. I just love that kind of last little fuck you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Oh, for a second, when you said undercuts, I thought you were going to complain that you didn't like it.
That's one of the things that I think is really funny in the movie.
Okay, well, good. Yeah, no. I
think it ends really strong.
I definitely agree. And that portly guy was in, like, every commercial in, like, the 1990s. Like, he is, I don't know his name, the heavier gentleman.
He was on Big Love for a long time.
I don't know his name. But he,
I don't either, but he's one of those guys who's in everything. Yeah.
Okay. So what else? I don't know.
I'm pretty good.
okay. Well. Hey, it's somewhat topical, but I was just thinking about this. You know, I'm like kind of a nerd for like just trying to figure out where things fit in terms of people's canons. Can I interest you in a game of best worst with Peter Weir?
Of course you can, but I should preface that by saying there's a number of Peter Weir films that I have not seen.
Okay.
Like, I know for a fact I have not seen The Cars That Ate Paris.
Oh, okay. I also, you mean the Cars That Eat People?
I believe the movie was released under two different titles.
Oh, okay. That's what I know it as.
I think we might both be right.
For once, we disagree and are both right. Very good.
Okay.
You can pin it to the things you've seen. That's what you have to do anyway.
Of what I have seen. Yikes. Okay.
Did you just cue it up on the?
I did. Yeah. I like The Truman Show a lot. I will say that while I did not love it at the time, Master and Commander has grown in my estimation a great deal.
Okay.
In the last few years, when I saw it felt like a chore. And now I like it a lot more. However, I'm going to throw a real curveball and pick a movie that I actually just recently saw for the first time as being his best. And that is Witness.
Oh, man. That's not a curveball. That's my answer.
Yeah.
That's,
well, yeah. It's a curveball only because I just saw it within the last 6 months.
Yeah. It's on Netflix, or it was at some point.
I believe that's how I saw it, actually. Yeah. That's a great fucking movie.
That movie is really, really good. Yeah. I'm with you. I have no arguments.
I had missed it for years, and it was a movie that I always heard about, and I was just like, yeah, the Amish movie with Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
And then it got talked about a lot when Looper was out, and Rian Johnson talked a lot about how much he was influenced by Witness, and I thought, well, that's fascinating. Now I really need to see Witness, and I saw it, and it's really fucking great.
That's one of those, like,
Harrison Ford in that movie, like, he, it's just weird because he's like such a prototypical movie star.
Yeah.
And he's just like that performance, like, it's not showy and there's nothing like, yeah. there's nothing to attach your franchise to or anything like that.
Yeah. And it's made for adults.
Yeah.
It's not made for 15-year-old kids. It's, yeah. It's just a movie that tells a story about people.
Yeah. It's really good.
Really good.
Yeah.
Worst for me.
Yeah.
Of what I have seen. Again, there's a few that I haven't seen, but I got to go Dead Poets Society.
Okay. Well, that turned out to be a really boring game because our answers are the same. I also saw Witness fairly recently, like also on Netflix. Until then, if I had not seen that, have you ever seen The Mosquito Coast?
Yes, I have, but it's been years.
Yeah, I really like that movie too. Anyway,
I think I saw that movie at an age where I was too young to really appreciate that movie.
Get the themes. You should seek that out again. That movie's interesting.
I've also never seen Fearless, which I hear is great.
I've not seen that either. Yeah, it's Jeff Bridges.
Jeff Bridges survives a plane crash. And I've never seen it, and I've always wanted to. But I have seen Green Card, and that movie is garbage.
Okay.
So Peter Weir runs a little hot coal with me. I mean, I think Master and Commander could have been my answer. I think even on the right day, The Truman Show could be my answer. But Witness is just so goddamn good that...
Yeah. I agree.
I got to go Witness.
Okay.
All right. Well, that was fun.
Yeah. A lot of fun.
Thanks for talking Truman Show with me, yo.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me back on. I am officially back in the saddle now. My life was in upheaval there for a little bit, so hopefully it won't be as long.
But now you're in New York, where, what's the lyric?
The concrete jungle where dreams are made of.
I've sang that lyric before.
It is so stupid.
And I like, never paid attention until you typed it out in an email. I saw where dreams are made of.
It makes no, like, I like that song. It's fine. But it was like, you read it. Exactly. You read it like, wait, what did she say?
She says where dreams are made of.
Where dreams are made of. I'm doing my best to make of my dreams out there on the concrete.
So, yeah. Outstanding. Thanks to everybody who participated in our Twitter and Facebook polls, and thanks for giving suggestions. Like I said, we will try and cover some of those other suggestions in future episodes. And we also may be doing something like that again in the future. So
definitely
look for those tweets and messages on Facebook. If you have a movie that you want to recommend, or remember, you can always email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. We will be back next week when our show might be about The Wolverine, although I can't promise anything. I can't promise it.
I will be the first to download. I will track it, and I will make sure I am the first.
All right, good. Anyway, thanks for listening, everybody. Alex, go ahead and take us out.
All right. You can slay me all you want for being too obvious, but good afternoon, good evening, and good night.